know it.
Okay.
Believe me, I'm counting.
Seriously, reload it.
Okay.
Look at Garb.
Have you think one more time.
Okay.
See if
that, that didn't come.
All right, let me know.
It's questions from Washington.
No, it didn't. It went through education.
Yeah.
I haven't voted no very often.
We're going to bring our
more than I have.
Rules Committee meeting to order today,
the
19th. And with that, what I'm going to do is open, and I'll take care of a little bit of business first. To begin with, we are going to carry over House Bill 3648 and House Bill 3307, the work sessions, to Monday. Waiting for some stuff that has not come to me yet, so I can't work on those. And we're going to carry over 3707, also to Monday. And with that, different order, we're going to start out with Senate Bill 1062A. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 1062A, and I'll have a short explanation while that the Secretary of State can come forward. Thank you very much.
48, 37, and 7. What was the third one carried over?
First three,
all House bills.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1062A requires a sample or imitation ballot and the back of any return envelope enclosed with the ballot to specify that the ballot is not a real ballot and cannot be used to vote. Allows the Secretary of State or Attorney General to impose a civil penalty not to exceed $10,000 for each violation of Oregon Revised Statute 260.295. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage. The member should also have received as part of their distribution -A4 amendment, which prohibits post-prepaid return envelopes from being included with or used with imitation or sample ballots within 45 days in advance of an election.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr.
Secretary.
Chair.
Yes.
Committee members, for the record, I'm Secretary of State Kate Brown. Thank you so much for giving Senate Bill 1062 a hearing. I introduced this legislation in this special session because I felt it was very important that we had statutory clarity around the issue of sample ballots. I think most of you know that during the special election, we received a complaint from the League of Women Voters regarding some sample ballots that folks received in the mail for a polling process. We felt like the statute needed clarification, felt very strongly that we needed to preserve the integrity of our elections process and make sure that there was no confusion around Oregon's ballot. As your committee administrator mentioned, the bill essentially does three things. It requires stronger notice for an imitation ballot that's not official. It sets a minimum 36-point font size for the disclaimer, and it imposes tougher penalties to deter violations. One of the things that was raised to me is that for first-time voters in our vote-by-mail system, they might not have ever seen a ballot until they receive one in the mail. So we wanted to make sure on these sample ballots that it was very clear that the sample size was large enough for even those with not great eyes to be able to read it and that there was no misunderstanding. We did receive in elections offices at least two of the sample ballots with actual ballots from around the state. And some of you might say that's not very many out of 1.3 million ballots. I guess as someone who won literally her first election by 7 votes, any confusion around this issue is absolutely not acceptable. So I would really encourage you to pass the bill in front of you. It came out of the Senate with 2 no votes, 28 aye votes, and came out of the Senate Rules Committee unanimously. I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
So are there any questions of this witness? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for getting here.
I'm just delighted to be here.
And so we have Marge Easley.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I am very proud to represent the League of Women Voters today.
Be sure and mention your name as well.
My name is Marge Easley, president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm proud to represent the League today on our anniversary of our 90th year in existence. We became the League of Women Voters in 1920. And I am proud to speak to some members of the League on the dais up here, Representative Nolan. The League supports an election process that encourages maximum voter participation and ensures ease of ballot access and use. We're strong proponents of the vote-by-mail system, and we want to make sure that it is successful with clear procedures and that the voters' trust will be maintained, that their votes will be counted. So we heartily support Senate Bill 1062A, which strengthens election laws concerning the use of imitation ballots that are mailed out to voters. We feel that it clearly spells out the exact wording and format of the language that must appear on both the outer and return envelopes, as well as the imitation ballot itself, and it imposes tougher penalties. We feel that these changes are a substantial improvement over current law and should eliminate any voter confusion over whether the imitation ballot is an official one or not. And we thank you for this opportunity.
So are there any questions of this witness? Seeing none, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I we appreciate your garb today and being out.
Thank you.
And Mark Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, also the owner of the Nelson Report, which is the organization that put out the simulated ballot. I'd like to give you a little bit of background. For about 25 years now, we have been using the concept of simulated ballot, which was actually developed by Gallup years and years ago. I'd like to first thank the Secretary of State and Senator Devlin's office for the amendments that were brought, that we agreed upon in the Senate to resolve our concerns about the original bill as it was printed. As the Secretary of State has indicated, there was a complaint during the recent campaign on ballot measure 66 and 67. And again, we just handed out to you what actually occurs in the simulated ballot, and I will talk briefly about the methodology that we do use. The ballot goes out in a number 10 envelope, like you see here. Originally, for many years, we had pre-printed the Nelson Report, but now we have it typed because we find that that increases the response rate. And inside, you will find the ballot. And many of you, all of you know what the typical ballot looks like. And of course, we have argued that we did not believe that there was any confusion, but obviously there was a complaint. We have indicated to the Secretary of State in previous discussions and in previous years that we were happy to cooperate to make this as clear as possible that it was not an official ballot. Our methodology, quite simply, is such where if we are going to, say, send out 100,000 ballots, in this case we sent out 110, we'll take the entire voter file, we'll give it an nth. Let's just say we have 1 million voters. We tell the computer, we'll go and select every 10th voter. That produces 100,000 voters at random. We then put those together and divide them up. Let's say we're going to have 10 mailings, as 10,000 for each mailing. We'll take every single zip code, as long as it has enough letters in it or enough ballots, and we'll break that into 10 separate mailings. So it's random in the selection and random in the mailing. The problem with mail ballots is that you can make your selection of your sample at random, but they don't come back in at random. So we have a formula in which we weight the actual demographics of the state, and that's how we use how we get the data, and that's what makes them so incredibly accurate. And in the last survey that we conducted on the last measures, we were actually at 50-47 with 3 undecided, and it became 53 and 54. All the undecided went to the yes side. But we use this in connection with telephone survey work. It is a data-based approach. We use this to track the effectiveness of campaigns, and it's a very important tool to us. Contrary to the complaint, or one of the complaints that was filed, we obviously do not target either a geographical area or a certain age group. Everything is picked at random. We don't do polls to give us answers that make us feel good. We do polls to give us answers that help us in crafting our campaign. So I thought it was important to let you know how we do and the purpose for how we do the methodology and the purpose for which we do these surveys. The language that you have in front of you from the Senate did meet our objections. Our concern was reduced return rate and increased cost. So the Senate, I think, met those considerations. At the same time, we're making it very clear, both on the return envelope and on the ballot, that this is not an official ballot. So we are supporting the bill as written.
Any questions for this witness? I just have one. Oh, Sarah? Representative Galsa.
Thank you. I have a couple, if that's okay.
Sure.
Great. Thank you very much. You had indicated that switching the return address to the typed, does that, why do you suppose that increases the rate of return?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, because it doesn't look like a bill or a solicitation, it looks more personal. That's what we found.
So when voters receive them, it gives them the sense that someone that perhaps knows them and gives them that sense that they know what they're opening?
Not necessarily. Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, it does say the Nelson Report. So mm-hmm. if they see that and they say, well, I don't know what the Nelson Report is, but it doesn't look necessarily as commercial as a pre-printed piece.
A follow-up question or an additional question?
Yes.
On a different line. So when these go out, they come with the little... the blue card. And I wondered if the results of these polls are available to anyone who wants to see them, or are they available only to the client or the campaign that pays for them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, they're only available to the client that pays for them.
Okay.
The Nelson Report does surveys. We're usually in the field almost 7 days a week for a variety of different clients. The clients who hire us receive the data, and it's confidential to them.
Follow up?
Yes.
Could you help me better understand then the line on the blue card that states the Nelson Report does not advocate the support of any candidate, nor does it advance the affirmative or negative side of any measure? Do you believe a voter reading this might take from that impression that there's a third party public interest nonpartisan group that may be tracking?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, I don't believe so. The Nelson Report, and this was an issue apart in the complaint, as you know, the Nelson Report is hired by Republicans, Democrats, businesses, cities, counties. It doesn't advocate. Mark Nelson may advocate as a campaign director or as part of a coalition for particular issues. But the Nelson Report was hired specifically to provide this service.
Can I follow up, please?
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. That, of course, is the prerogative of any business, and it's the way that it works. I think I struggle to understand what the point of that line is, and is that there to give the voter the impression of neutrality? And is there anything in this campaign mailing that would, for not just this most recent client, but for any of them, I know that these have happened before, how is a voter to understand that this really isn't a neutral? Is that your intent, for them to not understand that it's a neutral?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the Nelson Report does not advocate for any particular point of view. Because they are hired to provide a technical service, that is what they are providing. We have done, for example, in our campaign against term limits, which the League of Women Voters participated in, we provided very, very important data through this type of survey to win that campaign. So the state didn't have term limits. We have done it. We have used this kind of survey since the 80s against property tax limitations that we also ran in opposition to property tax limitations, which eventually we lost in ballot measure 5. It has provided data with basically the same type of information you see here for liberal to conservative, Democrat to Republican types of issues.
And I appreciate that part really wasn't my point. So let's take, for instance, when you were working on the overturning.
Another question.
Another question, please, Mr. Chair. On the term limits. So when you were advocating for that, and I assume the similar blue card went out, clearly the Nelson report itself does not advocate, but was acting as the emissary or the agent of a campaign to return that information to the campaign that that people were working on to not have the term limits. What was the point in that issue of putting that statement there? And is it reasonable, would a voter receiving this and reading it reasonably take away from reading this that it is a neutral survey that is being sent out? And do you believe that that is appropriate for that term limit campaign?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, yes, it is reasonable that the voter would think it's an unbiased survey, and it is an unbiased survey. Just as your printer who prints your campaign material doesn't advocate for you, the Nelson Report does not advocate for that particular measure. They are providing a technical service. And the respondent, whether it's by telephone or by mail, has every right or hope that their question, that their responses are going to be tabulated in a statistically valid way and without bias or prejudice.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yay.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, it would seem to me that the bullet point that Representative Gelser's been focusing on, most recipients of this would read this to mean that the person who reads the results of this survey is not an advocate in the campaign. And you've said that that's not the case. That while the Nelson Report is the conduit and compiler of the information, the recipient of the information actually is an advocate.
Representative Roblin, Representative Nolan, I don't know how to say it any other way. I am hired to provide a service, just like you hire your pollster to provide a service. That pollster is not an advocate for you. You are providing.
So Mr. Nelson, I understand. May I follow up?
Yes.
I understand that. I'm focusing on what the purpose of this message is. And it seems to me that the result of the message, whatever the intention is, and I won't even go to intention, but that most everyday people who read that message would think that they are replying to an entity, and that the only people who see the results of their survey, theirs and others, are neutral.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, it doesn't say that.
It doesn't say that, but I, may I follow up?
Okay.
Let me put it this way then. Would you object to language that makes it more clear that people who are advocates in the particular question are paying for the survey?
Representative Roblin, Representative Nolan, and I assume that is a obligation you want to put on every telephone pollster as well?
I'm asking you the question.
Yes, I would object.
Thanks.
Thank you. I have just one question. I didn't get the survey, so it wasn't something that came to my mailbox. And I did have a couple people ask me about it, and I told them it was a survey and so on and so forth. I would have gotten it. But I'm trying to figure out what was the time frame. I know you've done them before, and the only thing that I think could be confusing was, and I'm trying to remember when the person asked me. I'm not quite sure if it was during the time we were sending our regular ballots back. I don't remember that right now. So
no.
I'm just asking that to figure out when the survey was taking place, because I can see it being different at different times. So that's
Mr. Chairman, typically it's done 2 weeks out and daily into the election. So we will do the drops 6, 4 and 2 weeks out, and then continued our drops so that we're getting a sufficient sample size right into the election. Yes, it is done at the same time that the ballots are mailed out.
And that was true of the other ones as well?
It's been true of how we've done it for 25 years.
Okay.
Well, 25 years, but we haven't had a vote by mail since 1990 or
thank
whatever.
You. Thanks for the correction, because I forgot about that, too. Okay. That was, and it must have been at that same time that I was asked. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions, this witness? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
I guess what I'm saying is the original, I wanted to ask you, as the original bill, as the bill is written, when it came over from the Senate, that was something that was agreed to by a lot of different people.
That's correct,
so far,
Mr. Chairman.
Everybody that's spoken was feels that way. Okay.
No,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. We're going to call back our Secretary of State, Kate Brown.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record again, Kate Brown, Secretary of State. I just wanted to address two issues. One was the fact that the sample ballots came out after the time that our actual ballots came out. We did explore putting a time frame limitation
okay.
around that because of our concerns about the greater confusion with the actual ballots being in the mail. We were unable to do that from a legal perspective. Otherwise, that's something we would have pursued. And then secondly, to address tangentially Representative Gelser and Representative Nolan's concerns about the card. We did explore putting additional language in statute about other pieces in the mailer and putting restrictions on those as well. It just got, frankly, too complicated from a statutory standpoint and, frankly, from a free speech issue. So we chose in the Senate to keep it simple and straightforward so that the parties that were attempting to comply with the statute were very clear about what they needed to do to comply with the statute. This would not just apply to polling firms. For example, the League was here in the room. They are doing educational efforts around vote by mail. We will be doing those as well. We wanted to make sure that it was very clear for anybody trying to comply with the statute what the requirements were. So we did not move to regulating around other pieces in the mailing because we felt it was too complicated, frankly, and so chose not to take that route.
So any other questions for this witness? I guess then I would ask this then. As it is drafted, no amendments, just as it's drafted, is an agreement that you feel comfortable with at this time?
Mr. Chair, I do. And that was the agreement we reached in the Senate.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification for me. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this that didn't sign up? Because I think that's everybody that was on our sign-up list. If not, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1062A. And we're going to open a public hearing on 1014A. And we'll have Sasha Pollack come up while we have a short explanation of this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1014A allows state boards and commissions to meet by telephone or other electronic means, clarifies that members who participate by phone or other electronic means are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement for expenses, provides discretion to give per diem to non-elected members of boards and commissions not employed in public service full-time who participate in official duties by telephone or other electronic means, increases Oregon State Board of Pharmacy to 8 members and adds 1 licensed pharmacy technician, repeals Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, Columbia River Resource Task Force, and Healthy Streams Partnership, and is effective on passage.
Okay. So I'm also going to call up Lori Wimmer. We'll start with Sasha.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senate President Peter Courtney's office. Senate Bill 1014A is a presidential bill. It was worked on for the past about 8 months with the Speaker's office, with the Executive Appointments Department in the Governor's office, as well as many staff members for the existing boards and commissions as we could get a hold of. What this is a cleanup bill to make sure that statute is clear in terms of what it speaks to in terms of boards and committee boards and commission appointments, per diems, term limits, and there was a need for a clarification about whether or not teleconferencing and electronic means were legal, although they are currently being used. So it is our hope that what is in the bill that is before you simply codifies what's currently being done. Per diem was one of the things that was of most concern to the folks in the Senate. I believe, having talked to a bunch of folks, that this bill does not change anything that's currently going on in terms of giving or not giving per diem to members of boards and commissions, both legislative members and public members. This simply codifies what's currently being done and fills in some blanks that were in statute. I'm happy to answer any questions, specifically about the three task forces that are being removed. Those are all, for one reason or another, either they've finished their work, they've been combined with another, or they've been defunded. They are all inactive task forces.
Well, let's let Ms. Wimmer Whalen say a little bit about an amendment. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your record. Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. You have, I think, the A-12 amendments to Senate Bill 1014. This is a modest little proposal that fixes what we consider to be something of an injustice in current statute, which was discovered only in the current effort to replace Representative Lou Frederick, who had served on the State Board of Education, and when the governor's office was looking for candidates, and we were one of the various parties that were consulted about various names that might be appropriate from CD3. One of the candidates who emerged was a person who was a principal in the state of Washington but a resident of Oregon, and who would have been an ideal candidate except for one thing. The statutes prohibit an educator of any description, no matter where they work in any state, from being appointed to the State Board of Education, which we thought was pretty amazing. Didn't know. So we were looking for a place to put a correction to that. Our amendment simply would allow the governor, if he or she so chooses, to appoint someone who is an employee of a school district. It would not mandate that there be a slot for an educator, and it would not have a threshold number. In fact, we actually are trying to be self-limiting and explicitly say that it couldn't be a majority of the board members, because we wouldn't want undue influence by educators on a policy board. But just as in the higher ed board, there are two actual designated slots for employee faculty members, we believe that it would at least be nice to have the permission, if a governor were so inclined, to enable an educator to actually serve on an education policy board. So that is the genesis of the amendment and the substance of it.
Questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wimmer, did you, in your investigation, find any useful information on why this was the case, how it came to be?
Mr. Chair and Representative Reed, I didn't have the opportunity to go back through the archives building to look at old testimony from the statutes way back when, but I will tell you that it also used to be against the law, for example, for a teacher to serve on a school board, even in an adjoining school district. If you lived in one district and worked in another, you couldn't run for a school board, even if you weren't directly supervising the policies of a different district's employees. That was changed by a subsequent legislature. They thought that was unfair. And it's my understanding and belief that this kind of language and that kind of thinking originated from that time, when they thought that workers should never have that opportunity. And I wanted to make clear, we're not advocating solely for teachers to be appointed, potentially any educator, meaning principals, superintendents, other education employees. But I don't know if there was any kind of rationale. I will tell you that in our look at other boards and commissions with policymaking functions, they generally do have experts in that field on that board. So it seems to us only rational that you would similarly do so.
I think it's the A-12s, right?
A-12s.
Okay. In 1014. I think you said A-14s.
Oh, I did. I'm sorry.
I don't know.
We're all searching for 14.
Just wanted to see if you're awake on a Friday afternoon.
Okay. We're paying attention.
Apologize.
Okay. Other questions for either of these panel members? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we're going to close the public hearing on 1014A. And what do we have next?
It's the only one that hasn't somebody signed up.
And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 998A. And we'll have some testimony. Let's see, we'll ask Steve Trout to come forward. Sure, you can give a short explanation of the bill.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 998A modifies the date the Secretary of State is to submit a report to the Legislative Assembly regarding the cross-nomination system for candidates for public office, requires online voter registration card to be submitted by 11:59 p.m. on the 21st day before election, allows county clerks the discretion to determine if an address update is required when clerk receives notification from the National Change of Address System that voter's address does not match the address in centralized registration system, specifies that state initiative petition circulators registration is valid until 4 months before general election and the registration of circulator for referendum or recall petition is valid until the date the petition is filed for signature verification, expands the ability to vote by facsimile machine to all long-term absent electors, increases the financial threshold for the requirements to file a candidate committee to 750, deletes the requirement that candidate political or petition committee file notice to discontinue before final campaign transaction, conforms language regarding candidate committees in the appropriate statutes by deleting the word campaign, prohibits candidate or principal campaign committee of candidate, the treasurer of a political committee, and the treasurer of a petition committee from paying civil penalty from campaign contributions, prevents the disclosure of name, address, occupation, and other information for individuals who donate to the Oregon Political Party Fund, establishes a requirement for Secretary of State to distribute directives to county clerks, local governments, or special governments for fixing electoral district boundaries after redistricting is complete, deletes Oregon Revised Statute 246.410 sub 1 for creating, combining, or dividing voter precincts.
And with that, that was a lot. That was a mouthful. So we will have Mr. Trout explain what's going on. And I thank you for being here. And I appreciate the fact you've come before so we know this new employee of our state is. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Trout, Director of Elections. And I appreciate the committee administrators going through. I think there's 12 different sections here, all technical fixes, you know, clean up provisions either from the last session or to incorporate new things related to our online registration system or changes in federal law. So I'll just go through the sections and just give a brief explanation, and if there's any questions, I can go into further detail. Section one of the bill changes the deadline for us to report on the cross-nomination system to March 31st of next year from this year. Reason for that, so that we can see the results of it from the general election in November. So let's just see how it works before we give you the report. Section two puts in a timeline for a deadline for the online voter registration system that we're getting ready to roll out a week from Monday. It will set the deadline at 11:59 p.m. on the 21st day, which is consistent with our other online filing deadline periods. You'll still be able to have a postmark count or be able to go to the office during their office hours on that 21st day. This just allows that to stay open until 11:59 11:59 p.m. if you do that online. Section three of the bill relates to the National Change of Address form. We get those batched every so often with the more rapid pace of updating voter registrations, and especially in light of the online registration system coming online here shortly. Oftentimes counties have voter registration cards that are more recent than the National Change of Address form that comes back to them, and so this would allow them to recognize that this information that I have on this card is more recent, and so it keeps them from having to go back and replace it with bad information and gives them a little bit of discretion to do that they don't have currently. Section 4 deals with circulators of recall and referenda petitions. Currently, the deadline is 4 months before an election for those that are circulating initiative petitions. Unfortunately, with referendum recall, that may go beyond that period, and so this allows them to continue to circulate until those petitions are submitted so that they wouldn't have to terminate one committee and then re-register if it came around that four-month deadline. Section 5 of the bill brings our fax voting, which this body passed last year in compliance with the federal law changes, allows military overseas voters and their spouses and dependents to be termed as long-term absent electors, enabling us to receive fax ballots from them. Section 6 fixes a Measure 56 double majority issue that was not intended, and Section 7 increases from $350 to $750 the threshold for filing as a committee in Oristar. The reason for that is we raised the fees for voters pamphlet statements last year, and so this will allow those low budget committees or people that aren't really running a campaign to be able to purchase a voters pamphlet argument, pay their filing fee, and have a picture in the voters pamphlet and not cross that threshold. So it just reflects that increase in fees. Section 8 deals with the intent to discontinue a campaign committee. As it's currently written, certain committees can end up in a never-ending spiral, and so this corrects that so that they'll be able to discontinue their committee without having continuing penalties assessed when new ones come up. Section 9 is just a language cleanup, removing the campaign descriptor from expenditure. It's listed both ways in that section. Section 10 adds all committee types to the list of those that are not permitted to use campaign funds to pay civil penalties. And that section only deals with when those funds are converted for personal use. So any penalties for conversion of funds for personal use, this just makes them all the same, whether it's a petition or a candidate committee or any type of committee. Let's see, Section 11. New law comes into place with the checkoff boxes on the tax forms. Department of Revenue obviously has that information as confidential, and so the contributors would be anonymous. We can't have anonymous contributions under state law, and so this we want to make sure that the parties are not prohibited, don't violate the law by receiving these contributions from the checkoff boxes through the Department of Revenue. So this sets up an exception for the committees to be able to accept those donations, and then also will enable them to be able to track the expenditures from that. And then sections 12 and 13 and 14 deal with precincting. Last session, a bill was adopted to change the way that districts district lines are drawn. This bill rolls it back to where it was previously, which allows for the counties and the cities and districts to be able to better draw districts so that they don't end up with islands and multiple ballot types and all of that. And it's been a compromise. We recognize that as we get to the end of a 10-year period after the census, the lines start to get there's different islands and different things with the lines that aren't as clean as they were when they were drawn 10 years previously. So what this bill does is, again, rolls it back to the previous law, and then requires the Secretary of State's office to issue a directive at the beginning of a year or at the beginning of the redistricting process every 10 years after redistricting or after the census to issue a directive to the counties, to the districts, to the cities, so that everyone's using the same standards for drawing their lines, and those standards would be consistent with constitutionally proven principles and those that are used for the state and congressional districts. So in a nutshell, that's this long technical bill. Be happy to answer any questions if there's any on any detailed section of that.
Any questions for this witness with regard to this bill? I do want to note that I am waiting for amendments for this bill, and as such, we probably won't move it today, but it'll probably happen on Monday. They don't necessarily relate exactly to your issues. We're
okay.
Not changing any of your issues. We're looking at some other things, and so I just want to make sure that was clear. And you were the only person that was signed up to be a witness, so is there anyone else, since there doesn't appear to be any questions? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 998A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I'm going to take just a short, very short, five-minute recess. So we're going to recess our committee for a couple of minutes, and then we'll be back in a few moments. We're going to reconvene our rules meeting, and we have two other bills up for public hearings, and currently there's no one signed up to talk on them, so we will give a short explanation. Oh, I guess we do have someone. Okay. So we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 41A, and we'll have a short explanation of the resolution.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 41A proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to require annual sessions of the Legislative Assembly, provides that sessions beginning in odd-numbered years may not exceed 135 calendar days, and sessions beginning in even-numbered years may not exceed 45 calendar days, allows legislative session to be extended by 5 days with the affirmative vote of two-thirds of the members of each chamber, permits Legislative Assembly to hold a pre-session organizational session not subject to the limits on the number of calendar days permitted for a legislative session, prohibits action on gubernatorial vetoes during pre-session organizational sessions, refers proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at November 2010 general election. And there is one amendment that was in the distribution today, the dash A8, that limits action that may be taken by the Legislative Assembly in even-numbered years to memorial and resolution adoption, actions in sections pertaining to legislative officers, rules of proceedings and adjournments, and passage of bills or adoption of resolutions proposing constitutional amendments that appropriate or allocate monies or limit expenditures and regulate taxation or exemption or receive at least two-thirds vote in favor of passage in each chamber.
So we have heard what this bill is about. I would encourage everyone to look them over and look over the amendments, because I fully anticipate we will have a work session on this bill on Monday. But for right now, we will close our public hearing on SJR 41A, and we will open a public hearing on SB 1043. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1043 allows legislative staff to explain the vote of a legislator on a measure referred to voters, declares an emergency and effective on passage.
We can bring back that if we need to. So again, let me look at it one more time. This is a bill that we've been working on. I don't think there's any more amendments, but I want to just make sure. And so with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1043. And now we will open a work session on, we're going to do the one on the ballots.
Thank you.
So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1062A. Representative Mullen.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1062A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nolan moves Senate Bill 1062A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't ask any questions during this.
I know.
I don't have opposition to the bill. I simply, I don't know if amusing is quite the right word, but I found it quite interesting that we ask multiple questions of the guy who printed the bill, or printed the piece of material, but nothing of those who wrote the ballot title. So I just thought it was sort of ironic that we were talking a lot about the guy who's printing the survey, but not much about the way the ballot title was written. So okay. I just thought I'd throw it out there as a point of difference.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Representative, how do I go Gelser? Why do I go blank every once in a while? Thank you, Representative Gelser.
It's because it's left over from the education.
Yeah, it's true.
It's turnabout is fair play. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be supporting this bill. I think these are important adjustments. However, my yes vote is an endorsement of an improved policy. It is not an endorsement of this practice. Whether it is a practice for a measure I am in favor of or a practice for a measure I am opposed to. I think the difference between this and a telephone poll, when I get a telephone poll, I assume that someone is asking me questions because they're tabulating it for political purposes. Most people don't spend their time thinking about these things all the time. I talked to too many people that thought that this really was a ballot. They didn't know where it was coming from. I think it's a fair argument that this has happened before on other issues. I just think it's not a practice that I support. So I support making it better for people that use it, but it's not an endorsement of the practice.
Can I take a recess?
You bet you can.
I want to take a recess for 10 seconds. I think I'm okay. Thank you. We're going to come out of recess, and we were in the middle of a motion. Actually, we're ready to vote on a motion regarding Senate Bill 1062A. And I hope everybody has a clear idea of what 1062A is.
I'll quiz you afterwards.
And with that, we'll do a roll call vote. I think we're ready.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Hannah?
Aye.
Representative Jill?
We did it today.
Jensen. Representative Jensen.
Am I voting for Nelson or Jensen?
You're voting for Nelson.
Aye.
Let's do make sure we clarify that one before you call my vote.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Excused.
And Chair Roland.
Aye. Motion carries. That took us a little while, but thank you very much. We're going to close our work.
Carrier.
Oh,
wait.
Oh, assign the carrier. Parker's not here.
I think Representative Garrard needs, no, Mr. Chair, you should.
I'll carry this bill. Yeah, I will carry it.
I was going to give you a homework assignment over the weekend. Just
I'll carry the bill.
I'm going to give
You would.
So with that, we were going to close our work session on 1062A. Boy, that took a
if
while.
If we could.
thank you all.
These are the four matters to be carried over for work session.
Oh, yeah.
This we received. If you wanted to acknowledge, you have to do it in a work session. We just received it.
Oh, okay. Is that the new one that we had?
We have a hearing and we have a summary, but there's no testimony. If you wanted to acknowledge us today, you'd have to open the work session and acknowledge it and close the work session and carry it over.
So what is this?
It's a testimony in support
from
the
OBA.
Okay. But we can't receive testimony because the
That's right. Hearings. We can open the work session. I mean,
can
we can open it right
session.
Now.
Mm-hmm. We could and acknowledge this.
Just acceptance of a piece of paper.
Accept it on Monday.
Yeah. Can we do that? Yeah, we can do it Monday.
We can talk about it on Monday.
Okay. We can do it Monday.
Yeah, let's be
That's
careful.
Fine. I agree. So with that, we are going to move over. Did we carry this over as a work session? Work session only?
Okay. Yes, we did.
We're going to carry over 998A as a work session. We're going to carry over 1014A work session, Senate Bill 1043 work session, SJR 41A work session. I think that's all of it. Okay. And I think there may be one other bill that we're coming that may come out of the Senate that we will get to us on Monday. And so keep alert to that as time goes on, because I think we're getting close to the end of this session. So with that, we're going to close our rules meeting for today. Thank you all for being here. And
Thanks.
We don't have a rules tomorrow.